runasradio.com. You're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell and Greg Hughes. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 76 with guest Kimberly Tripp, recorded Wednesday, September 24th, 2008. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com.
You're listening to Run As Radio. I'm your host, Richard Campbell. With me, as always, my friend, Greg Hughes.
Hey, Richard. How are you today?
About me?
Oh, Kim, you're my friend, too. But I was trying to do, you know, our formal intro.
Shut up. Go ahead, do your intro. I'm sorry.
Who is that?
Who was that?
Run As Radio.
So how are you, sir?
I'm doing good. I'm doing just fine. How about yourself? You're back from more travels again, and I'm about to take off on some.
Back from Nepal. Unbelievable experience. I could do a whole show just on that, but I don't know that anyone actually cares. It was well worth my time, and I will go back someday, but not this week. This week I got to work.
That's terrific. So just so everybody knows, Richard goes to Nepal, and this weekend I'm going to Philly. So nothing
Almost
wrong with
the
Philly.
Same.
Nothing wrong with Philly, but you know it's it is a little different. So.
Hey, I'm really looking forward to TechEd Barcelona. We've got a great lineup there.
That's going to be a lot of fun. We'll both be in Barcelona. I think Kim's going to be in Barcelona too, right, Kim?
I will be there, and Paul, my husband, he'll be there as well. So a bunch of people. It'll be quite fun.
So great. If anybody hasn't guessed yet, our guest this week, the fabulous, the amazing, and my very, very dear friend, Kim Tripp.
Hello, Kim.
Hello.
And I managed to pry you away from Paul for a change, so I don't have
to... Hey, he's teaching today. This is a rare event
where
I'm in the house and it's empty and he's working. I mean, we were saying this morning that we've literally just spent about 6 or 8 weeks. I mean, I'd have to look at a calendar, really, but 6 or 8 weeks straight where we actually didn't even separate in any way, shape, or form. Like, 24 hours a day for 8 straight weeks. So it's kind of funny. It was almost weird when he was going to work this morning.
Don't leave me.
Yeah, I don't know how to be kind of around here when you're not around. So,
well, you two have been inseparable for years now.
Yeah, I guess a couple of years.
Yeah.
It's actually, you know, it's going really well. I really like the whole working together, you know, quote unquote playing together as well. But the work side is, it makes things so much less stressful to have somebody else on stage. I really didn't do that many co-presenting presentations over the last few years, but it's great because I forget things, he forgets things, I remind him, or sometimes I just have a different spin on something, or he does, and it's really nice because I think we actually can convey more information and cover more aspects of the information because we have different perspectives. And yet,
right,
we don't have to work quite as hard because we're not both standing up by ourselves for 8 straight hours.
Sure. So, plus, it's just so much fun to listen and watch the two of you interact with each other. So
yeah. Well, I hope that's going to be the case. I'm actually a little bit nervous of our you know possible spinoff here that we've talked about now for like over a year.
Yes,
but, that's right.
Yeah, I think it'll be really fun. I mean, it will be one of those things where we'll have to figure out what we want to talk about and then maybe not tell each other what we're going to say.
Of course, we're talking about KPI, which is going to be Kim and Paul's show on SQL Server when it actually launches, which is imminent, I know, soon.
It is. We're actually working on the website.
Nice.
And coming up with a few of our themes. And our name, you know, Kimberly Paul, and then I is, you know, all over the map. It's investigate, introduce, insanity, depending on the show, and you know, so we're going to kind of have a different theme almost for every show. I mean, you guys kind of go all over different technologies. Obviously, we're going to focus on just SQL, but we'll focus on different aspects of SQL, and we'll have interviews. That'll be, you know, another eye, and it'll be quite fun. I mean, we started to get all the equipment put together, and we had to kind of rearrange part of the house to make sure we could have a place to record that would be really good for recording, and so
right.
it's been a long process, but we're getting really, really close. So
it's exciting.
I'll be real excited to see what you come up with. It'll be great.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. At a minimum, it'll be fun and, you know, hopefully informational, informative. So
today's I is indexing.
Oh, yeah, indexing.
There you go.
iPhone. Oh, wait.
There are so many I's.
So many I's. Because SQL 2008 is really, they've done some big things with indexing.
Well, you know, 2008, in terms of indexing, it has one, I think, really interesting and kind of big new feature, and that's filtered indexes. They didn't really change any of the internal structures for the most part. You have the same kind of indexing strategies that we had in 2000, 2005, which is, you know, create a decent clustered index so that your non-clustered indexes are not unnecessarily wide. I even had a few questions. I taught an indexing class in Edinburgh about 2 weeks ago, and it was a nice small class that was actually really quite fun. And the fun part about it being nice and small is we actually went into more depth and more areas than I've gone into in some of my indexing classes because there's just so many more people that you end up with a lot of questions. But with
right.
less people, you get, I think, a little bit more depth. So anyway, I had interesting questions, and sometimes people are almost shocked by the fact that a clustered index has to be unique, and the end result of a clustered index, which is unique, is that every non-clustered index is unique. And it was kind of this realization, I think, for a few folks where they kind of went, wow, I never even thought about that. The selectivity of, you know, a combination of columns in a non-clustered plus the clustering key, of course, if your clustering key is unique, is one.
Right.
And it kind of makes for some interesting, like I said, realizations about indexes and what they look like. And that's what the class was a lot about, was index internals and good indexing strategies for better performance. So it was quite fun. It was quite fun. And talking about internals for a couple of days seems really geeky, but I had, you know, many people that told me, the light bulb is on now. I get it. I see why it's so important to make a good decision on a clustered index and then the impact of that in non-clustered. I don't know if you want me to just go on a tangent.
But I think you're hitting on a very interesting, this is really the line of, you know, what does a DBA do these days? Because account creation is largely handled. You know, SQL Server does so much of its own care and feeding. Here is the one area, I think, more than anything, where it really takes a person looking at the way the app behaves against the database to say, what are the right indexes?
Yeah, it's so funny that you say that, because one of the things I think I've been saying a lot more in even just the last few months is that good indexing and having the right indexes for performance purposes, it's a combination of both an art and a science.
Right.
There's definitely a science to it. I can look at a query. I can tell you what kinds of indexes exactly would help that query. I mean, the answer to what's the best index for a query is always one answer, a non-clustered covering seekable index.
Right.
I mean, period.
That's the fastest, period.
What's that?
That is the fastest.
Yeah, exactly. If you can cover it, right, that means that you have the smallest absolute structure to use to find your data. If you can make it seekable, like the phone book, you only have to go to the section that's of interest to you, or the name, for example, in the phone book that is of interest to you, right? So you get right to the section, all of your data is right there, and you don't have to go into the full-on, let's say, table to look up the data. So you skip all that extra work. So if you can have
all that overhead. Yeah,
all the overhead, absolutely. So if you can have this non-clustered covering seekable index, then, you know, you can significantly improve your performance. But you can't cover everything is the point that is the hard part, because the desire from a tuning perspective always seems to be, let me look at a query, tune it. Let me look at a different query, tune it. Let me look at a different query, tune it. And the end result is you end up with too many indexes. So the art part of it is trying to determine if you could, let's say, add a column to an index, which you can't really directly add a column to an index, but if you could create an index that is maybe a little bit wider than an existing index and then drop that slightly narrower index, you might actually end up with an index that has a lot more uses and a lot more benefits. And then that's the other problem that I always seem to have to overcome is the, I don't know, Carl Jung would probably say it's from the collective unconscious or something, but it, this desire to create wider indexes, or I should say this unbelievable, repulsion at wider indexes. Everybody
yeah.
seems to have it. You know, nobody wants to have wider indexes. And I always find that I'm spending, you know, time kind of trying to show or prove the point that having a whole bunch of narrow indexes that aren't being used is way worse than having a couple of wide indexes that have a tremendous number of uses.
Because each one of these indexes has impact on writing performance.
Yeah, absolutely. And the more indexes in and of themselves, even if they're narrower, can often have a more profound impact on inserts, updates, and deletes than having just, let's say, one or two wider indexes.
Right.
Even though it might
right.
be more disk-based. You know, the potential for splits, if you only have, let's say, three wider indexes, is 3.
Right.
But if you have 14 really narrow indexes, you have the potential for 14 splits.
Yeah, it's an interesting and sometimes counterintuitive balancing act, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the art part of it, you know? And that's what you constantly end up with, you know, this struggle between what seems logical. Oh, I have a where clause. I want to put an index on this one column. Yet, if it's not selective enough, then that index is just not going to get used. And that index is pretty much nothing but wasted overhead. And in fact, it might not get used at all. So it, you know, as far as new features, 2005 introduced DMVs, the dynamic management views, that will allow you to start to see, let's say, if an index does or doesn't get used, or if it does get used, how it's getting used. And you can even start to see from the DMVs if it's being used for seeking and for lookups, or if, for example, it's only being used by modification statements.
Right.
So you can even start to get this feel, wait a minute, this index, it's being used, but for nothing but updates, you know? And then you can start to look at these DMVs and decide maybe that you should get rid of some indexes. But the problem with them, I don't know how much you guys have had sessions about DMVs, but the problem with DMVs is that, you know, they're not persisted since the beginning of time.
Right.
They just kind of give you a right now, what does memory look like? And what's going on? The usage DMVs are quite nice because they do kind of keep information around, but if you shut down SQL Server or detach a database, you tend to lose a lot of that information in many of the DMVs. So the idea in 2005 was to kind of persist that data so you could do some trend analysis. In 2008, there's a new feature called Performance Data Collection that will collect certain information about queries. So it's not tracking directly index usage information, but it's tracking queries, so that you can start to do some trend analysis over, let's say, 14 days. That's the default trend information, right? So 14 days, and then you can start to see what queries are the most common and which queries are the most expensive. And, you know, you can even change the data that's collected and create your own custom data collection and then go back and do some analysis on that. So, you know, all of those things together will hopefully get someone closer to determining if, let's say, the indexes that they have shouldn't be there. And once they start whittling that down, they'll probably find out that they don't end up with too many indexes, and then they'll probably get a lot of missing index recommendations. So that's another DMV. And I always feel like I need to pause. You know, it's really cool. I mean, it's a great capability that they added in 2005. And I think they're getting a lot better with 2008. A lot of people start getting cranky with me and saying, well, why don't they just create the indexes for me or drop the indexes for me? And that's a whole nother discussion. It's really hard to do. I mean, really, really hard to do.
Didn't the profiler have a wizard for this at one point?
Yeah, well, actually, no, that's a great point. Profiler for tracing allows you to capture a workload,
right,
which is very much like the idea of performance data collection, you know, capturing information about queries, for example. But Profiler can trap, you know, a whole bunch of other stuff. It can it can, if you want, I wouldn't really recommend this, but you could just, let's say, trace all the locks that are going on. You'll really kind of hurt your performance by doing that because it's so expensive to kind of take that in-memory thing and persist it. But you could do all sorts of stuff. Once you have a workload, one of the things you can use is a tool that most people associate with Profiler, which is, I think, why you said that. But it used to be called Index Tuning Wizard.
Right.
So it was a wizard-based tool. And the Index Tuning Wizard, which was the 2000 tool, would allow you to go and look solely at index recommendations. In 2005, they changed the name. It's called the Database Engine Tuning Advisor, or DTA for short. Everybody just calls it DTA. And DTA does not just indexes, but also partitioning. So they changed the name. But it really is kind of the ITW with quite a few enhancements, to be honest. But it's kind of the progression of it. So it also has a very, I'd say, a pretty intuitive UI that's kind of wizardy in that it has recommendations and then you kind of just go, you know. And it's good. It's actually, in many cases, I would say much better than relying solely on the DMV, because the DTA will look more comprehensively at a workload and it won't just say, this index hasn't been used. How do I want to say this? If you look at the DMV and the DMV had been wiped out a few days ago because somebody bounced the server
right.
and no one had persisted the DMV, right?
Yeah.
Then you find out, oh, this index hasn't been used in the last 3 days. So then you might kind of make a bad decision to drop it when maybe the index is actually really critical for, let's say, month-end processing.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking is, and I think it's the same problem with the profiler too, which is if you've only taken a one-hour workload,
yeah, exactly.
You know, your month-end stuff is not going to show up in that unless you ran that workload during the month-end.
Yeah, totally. And that's why I really like, I like DTA. And I like Profiler, but it's kind of like all of the tools are fantastic, especially if you know kind of exactly what you should do with them and
yeah.
exactly how to use the tool. Because each tool has pros and cons, you know, weaknesses and even faults in some cases, because it can only do, it's, you know, it's the old garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah. And well, and you hinted at this whole thing of the Profiler exerts a non-trivial load on the server to make its record in the first place. So the prospect that, it, you know, the reason you're tuning the month-end workload is it's already too slow, and now you're going to turn Profiler on and make it even slower.
Yeah, I mean, this is a great point kind of in and of itself, is profiling for better performance usually leads to short-term worse performance.
Bad performance.
You know, the good news is that there's all sorts of tips and tricks out there on how to do what's called a server-side trace. Which is kind of lighter weight than using the Profiler UI to actually profile. You can use the UI to kind of generate the details of a trace, which is all code-based, and then you can create that trace on the server so that the server runs the trace and logs it directly to a file on the server. Nothing goes over the network, nothing goes to the UI, and you can even then programmatically like start and stop the trace through jobs, for example, or even, you know, you could have an alert, like a raise error message that raises a user-defined error that then triggers an alert which kicks off a trace. I mean, you can do some really cool stuff when you use kind of the code aspects of server-side tracing as opposed to just using Profiler itself. So I actually did a webcast. I think everything's still downloadable because it's still fairly applicable, but I did a MSDN webcast series a few years ago now, and part 9 was on profiling and server-side trace queues. So poke around for that. I've got a link to that on my homepage as well, and I think all that still exists easily downloadable. So, but yeah, you know, you're always going to pay a penalty.
What are some of the other indexing questions you get? I mean, you do a lot of webcasts, and you certainly do a lot of presentations. People come up to you afterwards. I assume you probably get a lot of clarifying questions. Are there some that are pretty common? Maybe good things just to sort of talk about here.
Yeah, tons. I mean, tons. One is always related to the structures and why does a clustered index need to be unique? Because SQL Server doesn't tell you that you have to make the clustered index unique, but yet internally, if your clustering key is not unique, SQL Server will, quote-unquote, uniqueify that clustered index. So what ends up happening is your insert performance, your update performance can actually be slowed by having to, you know, check and then uniqueify the row.
Right.
So a lot of people ask me, like, why? Why does the clustered index need to be unique? And it actually has to do with non-clustered indexes. If you think of, I'm trying to think of kind of the really simple example that would be perfect. Like, imagine a table that is employee data. I use this one in a lot of presentations, but imagine a table that is employee data, and the data happens to be ordered by, let's say, last name, okay, which is not a clustered index I would recommend. But somebody chooses because they think range queries are going to be better with a clustered index by last name. So they decide they're going to cluster it by last name. Well, then they decide they also need to look up employees by social security number. So they create a non-clustered index on social security number. In SQL Server, as of 7.0, when they re-architected the storage engine, SQL Server 7.0 and higher uses, if a table is clustered, the clustering key to do the row lookup. So, again, imagine this non-clustered index on social security number, and you run a query, select star from table, where social security number equals 12345678. You go into this index, and sitting there with social security number, blah, 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 is the last name Smith. Well, I don't know if that's going to help you all that much, right? You might have a couple hundred Smiths. So then you have to go back, let's say, and scan through all the Smiths to find the Smith that has the social security number of 12345678. So they don't allow the clustering key to be non-unique because of this exact problem. They wouldn't know exactly which row to reference. So when you create a clustered index on last name, instead of like the 200 rows all being Smith, 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 each non-unique row that goes in gets uniqified. So they add a 4-byte integer that internally is stored in the variable block of the row. Okay, so you can't really see it. It's kind of hidden. I mean, you could if you did a DBCC page and actually looked at the raw row formats themselves. But outside of that, it's totally hidden. And it's a 4-byte uniquifier that ends up not only getting stored in the row, so you have extra 4 bytes in the row, but then you have the extra 4 bytes in the index, so that now 12345678 Smith is not just Smith, it's Smith 47. Right? So then you know exactly which row it is to look up to find the rest of the data. And I think that's really interesting. And most people would then say to me, 4 bytes, Kim, you know, give me a break. Is that really a big deal? Exactly. But you've got 4 bytes extra in the row, 4 bytes extra for every uniqueifier that's needed in every non-clustered index, right? And you're just, it's kind of like unnecessary overhead that you're not benefiting from, and it just doesn't make sense. So that's one thing.
So what if you don't create a clustered index?
So if you don't create a clustered index, then you end up with a heap. And a heap structure is an unordered structure, so the order of the rows is irrelevant, and rows can move freely, for example, if they get modified. But then something interesting happens, because imagine having a table. This is actually a great discussion. I really like this one because I think this surprises people. Imagine having a table where the data doesn't have any order, right? Then you have a heap. But then put this non-clustered index on social security number on it. Well, if we have to look up the row and the table doesn't have any order, then where is the row, right? So we have to have this thing called a row ID. And the row ID is an 8-byte value. So that's fine. That's not a big deal, okay? So now we have a non-clustered index that has this row ID that points us to the physical location of the row. But then what if the row itself gets updated? And the update makes the row larger, such that the row cannot fit on the page that it's currently on. Because it's a heap, SQL Server doesn't do splits. They do something called record relocation. So they'll take this row independently, and they'll move it to another page owned by this table, or they might even have to allocate a new page, but they'll move this row to where it would fit, and then imagine what would have to happen. They'd have to tell the non-clustered indexes where this row moved. So instead of making these RIDs, what we call they used to be called kind of a volatile rid, meaning that when the rows moved around, the rids would have to change. So all the non-clustered indexes would have to be notified, essentially, for this row that it had moved. And if you had, let's say, 10 non-clustered, 20 non-clustered, 30 non-clustered, which is a lot, but if you did, all this record relocation would have to be fixed in all of your non-clustered indexes. And kind of having said that, that was 6.5. 6.5 did that. Every time a row moved, all of the non-clustered indexes would have to be touched with the new location, the new physical, that's what I wanted to call it before, the new physical RID. So they had actual physical RIDs in pre-7.0 days. So they changed that. In 7.0 and higher, they used this what they call forward-pointing system to allow a row to move, but to not change the non-clustered indexes lookup by essentially leaving the non-clustered indexes pointing to the original location, the fixed RID, where it got inserted, and then if it moves, they have an 8-byte forwarding pointer that points to the new location of the row.
And every time the row gets updated, that pointer would be updated.
And every time the row moves, then the pointer gets updated. You don't end up with a chain. It just goes to the new final location.
Right. But you now you're paying the penalty on the select for that double seek as opposed to the penalty on the update whenever when all the indexes need updating.
Exactly.
Interesting trade-off.
Yeah, and this is one of my reasons for why heaps are not necessarily the best choice in more and more volatile tables. Because the more volatile the table, the more of these forwarding pointers you can end up with, and the more random your IOs can start to become because
right.
your rows might be doing two physical lookups in the leaf, you know, or in the table structure, essentially.
Right.
And then that always leads to the question, well, if a non-clustered just has this one lookup into a heap and a non-clustered on a clustered has to go through a tree and the tree of a clustered index could be, let's say, three or four levels, doesn't that create more excessive IOs than this lookup to the actual RID? Because think about it. If you only have to go to the RID, and even if it has a forwarding pointer, let's say that's two IOs max. One, maybe two IOs. But in a clustered index that has four levels, you'd argue you have four IOs no matter what.
Right.
Right? So two versus four is a pretty easy, you know, wow, two sounds better than four. Ironically, and this is the thing that I think people have the hardest time with. Ironically, the four is actually better. And that, okay, let me explain. The levels of the tree, the roots and the intermediate levels, are rarely not in cache.
Right.
Okay? They're almost always in cache. The place where you're most likely to encounter a physical IO is in what we call the leaf level. And the leaf level of the clustered, right, in a clustered index is always one IO, whereas in a heap, since you have this potential for a forwarding pointer, the potential in a heap, especially with forwarding records, is that you could have two physical IOs.
Right.
Because it's not likely to have that whole table in cache. So, isn't that ironic that it's like the clustered index has always gotten a bad name because it has multiple levels and it just looks bad. Four looks worse than two. But when you actually break it down to the cost of the IOs, it tends to be, in a table especially that has a lot of forwarding pointers, a more expensive process to do the IOs in the heap than it is in the clustered table. So I always find that really interesting.
You know, we're walking around a subject here around these clustered indexes, which require this uniqueness. Should I don't even know if I should tip this over, the natural key versus artificial key debate.
Oh no, Richard!
You don't even want to go.
How much time do we have? I can go there with reasonable. It's funny. I do sound passionate. I do love SQL Server.
Right.
And I actually have a hell of a lot of fun with it. I mean, I really do. Oh,
yep.
You don't have to beat that, do you? But anyway, sorry. But I mean, I really enjoy this product. But I'm not one of the ones that will get onto news groups or you know forums and become like, you know, psycho crazy woman on some point, you know, And I maybe that's one of the reasons why people can you know, agree with me on things. I'm not totally psycho normalization person, or
right.
I'm not totally psycho have to have a natural key.
Yes.
I kind of, to me, my philosophy has always been, know how the product works, and if you're lucky enough to, let's say, only have to work with one product, like, for me, SQL Server, the good thing is that you can make your decisions based on knowing your data, knowing how it's going to be used, and knowing how the darn product is going to use it, right?
Yep.
And with those three things, you can make so much better decisions than just going, oh, I need to believe in normalization.
Yeah, there's no one right way.
Yeah, and that's, oh, people get so frustrated with me, and I know Paul does this, every question starts with the answer, it depends.
Yes.
You know? And I know that's frustrating, but it's frustrating, but it's a good thing. It's the SQL Server is incredibly flexible, and of course that has its bad sides too. It's incredibly flexible. If you know what you're doing and can make really good decisions based on your data and how it's being used, you can actually get some great performance. If you just want to take the simple route and just apply rules, there are definitely some rules that are better than others, but I rarely am a always abide by relational theory rules kind of person.
Well, and so one of those rules being, it sounds to me like creating a clustered index is a good idea.
And that's, there's a rule. There's a rule that I like, creating a clustered index. And not just create the clustered index on the primary key, which is the default behavior, and
right.
I've never really totally agreed with that, but it does kind of make sense because your primary key has to be unique.
Yes.
So, hey, the clustered index has to be unique. Your primary key should be non-volatile. To be honest, that's another attribute of a clustered index.
Yep.
I don't want it changing because then it would cost me to change it in all the non-clusters.
Right.
So there are things that make sense, but then certain primary keys can be really problematic, like a natural key. I mean, often a natural key is one that takes 3 or 4 or 5, I've seen 10 columns to actually make the row unique.
Right.
And instead of creating a surrogate or a part number, for example, they want to go with this natural key. Well, I can name like 10 problems with this. It's going to make your non-clustered indexes wider than they would normally need to be because you're going to waste all this space duplicating all 10 columns in all of your non-clusters.
Right.
Right. It is unique, yes, but now certain aspects might change because there's 10 columns involved. I doubt that all of them are completely static, but maybe. I mean, maybe, let's say they are, right? Now, what about your foreign keys? Your foreign keys are unnecessarily wide. So now you've not only widened your base table, well, maybe not widened your base table, but you've widened all of your foreign key reference tables.
Yes.
And your indexes are going to be really wide, and really wide indexes, when you start talking about joining really wide indexes, it's not as ideal, right? I always talk about wide indexes in the context of seeking data and finding data, but now joining data is different. I usually don't want to have crazily wide indexes there. So it is one of those things that the rules take time to really bring together, but I don't tie them to just, you know, the base theory on which they started. Believe me, I do recommend knowing relational theory, but I don't necessarily apply every rule to the way that I design a table or a database. And so the clustered index, for me, should be something that's unique, narrow, static, and preferably something that's like ever-increasing, so it can create a pattern to my data that ends up having less splits, less fragmentation, and often even better performance due to hotspots. And that's another big question that I get. I don't know how much more time we have, but another big question I get is, what about hotspots? Are hotspots good? And I'll just sum this up by saying, actually, because of row-level locking, hotspots can be good.
Right.
And that's another very counterintuitive concept that people struggle with for the first couple hours, and then I beat it out of them.
that having a very active part of the table, the whole thing ends up cached.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
And row-level locking means they don't conflict. We got to hate hotspots in the older versions of SQL Server because of page-level locking.
Richard, you always surprise me with your little past nuggets of information that I just wouldn't have expected you to know all the way back. But you're right. That's absolutely accurate.
Well, it was, the only memories I have are painful ones.
Yeah, that's true. They're harder to get rid of.
Yeah. This is just scar tissue you're talking about.
Yeah, totally. Totally. 6.5 page level locking was a nightmare. And it made us all not want to have ever-increasing keys because we'd serialize our inserts.
Right.
Right? And it was horrible.
When you hit that moment where the right thing to do was to increase the lock contention level because it actually worked better, that's when you went home and sobbed in your pillow.
Yeah.
I remember actually setting to serializable, and then it worked better.
Sadly, that could, because you end up holding locks for a longer period of time, so you end up with sometimes less deadlock, and sometimes more. It depends.
Right, you enforce the order of insert through the stored procedure. Things worked better, and
that's true in some cases.
When it actually happened to me, I swear I cried because it went against every gut reaction you had. This shouldn't be better. Why is this better? I'm sad that it's better.
The good old days, right? The good old days. I laugh at that too. You know, SQL Server 6.5, you honestly did have to work a lot harder for better performance. And I think a lot of people forget that there have been so many improvements in the product that do make things way easier, like memory management, cache management, especially, that people get hung up on how complex indexing is. But at the same time, a lot of stuff is made easier, and then we need to finesse and figure out the right types of indexes. But at least not indexing every single column just because you can, and avoiding some of those mistakes. If you can avoid those and slowly work on better strategies, it is a lot more effective.
Start with a good clustered index. Build your nons carefully. Fewer is better. Wider isn't automatically a sin.
Wow. There you go. We should just end that. That's a great summary. It's perfect. Perfect. I totally agree.
Oh, that's awesome. Kim, I think we are out of time. We would change gears now and go another 40 minutes easy, but maybe we'll save that for another show.
I'm always surprised when you're in there.
And sometime this fall, we're going to get to see the first episodes of KPI.
Can't wait for that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They are imminent.
Awesome. Kimberly Tripp, thank you so much.
Thanks, Kim.
Thanks, you guys.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.